Channel's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. So if I understand your latest blog post, the pandemic recession has become the great reset, sort of like a general strike that has empowered workers in a way that unions used to do.
Roger?
That is absolutely great way of framing it. It is a way that maybe this the emotional hangover of the pandemic plus the dynamics of the labor market have put a lot of power in the workers' hands. And what's been really interesting is twofold. One is, how are workers wielding that power? And two, how are employers responding to the shift in the dynamic? Some of them don't seem to be so, I don't know, they don't seem to be really hep on giving over their power, shockingly.
The employers, you mean?
Yes.
Huh. One of the things that I thought the economy's been lacking is an attempt to bring back those jobs that don't require 4 years of college, because you have a lot of people who either don't want to or aren't suited to it. And it looks like that is happening or not.
Definitely happening. Okay. What the labor market has done, the tight part of the labor market in certain sectors, obviously, is it's forcing employers to cast their nets wider and to reevaluate which jobs do require a college degree. Maybe it's better for me to take a high school graduate and train him or her myself and give them that on-the-job training or some sort of certificate training that would get them to the level that they need to be at. You know, I'm hearing so many people saying to me, you know, why go to a four-year college, be $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt when I can go out and get a job right now and really get some training? And I think that was the missing component. There were always this idea that, you know, there are plenty of people in the labor force who don't have college degrees, but they felt they were stuck in dead-end jobs. Companies are now saying, we'll bring you in, but we're going to try to give you a pathway to move up in the organization. By the way, notwithstanding that very critical article of Amazon last week that was in the New York Times, which said that Amazon does not do that.
Yeah. So what would you advise to people who are thinking about getting back into the job market after maybe having taken a break either for parenthood or something else? Is this a good time or not?
It's an unbelievable time. And what I would encourage you to do is that to really consider what is important to you. Obviously, you want to make money, but do you really want flexibility as the main component of your negotiation? There are a lot of companies out there, in order to remain competitive, what they've done is they've said, we understand that the landscape has changed. We'll give you the opportunity to work in a hybrid model. We'll give you the opportunity to work from wherever. We just want you to get your work done. Whereas there are other kinds of companies, I'm sitting here in New York City, where big banks and financial institutions have been kind of rigid and said, you know, absolutely, you must come back 5 days a week. And by the way, if you're out at a restaurant, then you have to be at work. And that's a really different model, obviously. Now, they'll pay you a boatload of money to come work for those banks, but maybe for many people, they've learned a lesson of the pandemic, which is, I really want to be close to my family. I don't want to spend hours of my life commuting anymore every single day. And I would like to work in an organization that is not rigid, but flexible. And that flexibility is the most important component of my work-life balance.
Now, a lot of the reasons that workers have this power to make these kinds of choices is that they had all this unemployment money rolling in.
Yeah.
That's going to be cut off soon. Does that change the equation?
Well, I mean, I think that gets a lot of people back, but they're already coming back. You know, unemployment, that $300 a week is already going to be, is really sort of being curtailed in 25 states already. I think people realize that. But there are a lot of people out there who said, the pandemic taught me that I don't need to live on as much. I saved a lot of money, and now I'm ready for my new endeavor. What's next for me?
Okay, now big picture, us versus China economically. Is there any chance of using this opportunity to bring back more of the manufacturing work that was essentially offshored?
Yeah, there is. But listen, the manufacturing part of our economy is still the smaller part of the economy. So I think that all of the emotion around U.S. manufacturing and all of the attention that it gets, it's kind of like focusing on the wrong part. You know, it's not the bigger ass part of our economy is the service sector. And that's where we really need to kick it into gear. because so much of that manufacturing sector has not been affected so much by globalization, but by technology, right? Mm-hmm. By the ability to put a car together much more quickly with automation. So, you know, when we, I think that there's going to be more nearshoring or multi-sourcing in order to kind of not feel like you're controlled by the supply chain. But I don't think that's the major part of what's going on in the U.S. economy.
Aren't we a little too dependent, though, on China's brand of police state capitalism? I mean, they are clearly determined to show that their system, which involves the rigid regulation of workers, is economically superior to our system. Don't we have to engage in this a little more strongly?
You know, that's a leading question, I think, in law. Isn't it the fact that...
well,
yes, it
you
it
tell
is.
Me, you're the expert. I worry about that, though, because they're I don't like their model. I mean, it's extremely successful, right, in terms of churning out product. But look at the way it treats people.
Sure, of course. But, you know, listen, there are instances throughout history in the United States where we do business with and we are part of an economic structure with regimes that are kind of disgusting. And I think that companies are trying to make their decisions. I think the Biden administration has been actually somewhat tougher about China, not just, you know, sort of throwing stuff out there in terms of words, but some actions that are behind it than the Trump administration. And I think what's going to be interesting is, will the Chinese people be the ones that really determine this, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you have companies like Apple that have decided to say, you know what? So it's a, you know, a totalitarian slash capitalist regime. We'll do business there. It's still our big market, right? And will the people of China finally say, hey, you know what? We're not putting up with this anymore. I don't know. But I agree with you. There are a lot of places where we do business. I've had conversations with CEOs in around various things around the world where I say, well, how is it that you're doing business in the Middle East like this? Or, you know, how do we feel about doing business in a place where women have to use separate entrances and can't drive? How do we feel about that? And how do we feel about places where essentially there is a structure in place that keeps the people down? And, you know, as a country, we have to make a decision, and so do businesses. Businesses themselves, every single big company is doing business in a place where they're holding their nose and doing business. Is that something that those companies and their shareholders want? That's for them to decide. But for, I agree with you that China is a big one. Certainly Turkey is a big one. And you think about how East meets West, and a lot of these big oil producing nations are their big ones. So we make these gray area choices all the time. It's tough. It's hard to have morality when you're trying to make money for your shareholders.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Just as everything is reopening, here we're learning about a whole new variant. It's called the Delta variant. It sounds really evil. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So explain what is different about Delta.
The Delta variant was first noted in December of 2020 in India. But now it's given rise to really another wave of COVID-19 in the United States. And so there's concerns that it could really cause a setback both nationally and internationally to sort of ease the pandemic restrictions.
But I've been hearing that the current vaccines are pretty effective against even Delta. Now, is that, do you still believe that's the case?
Right. So it seems that that's the case. I mean, that's our current understanding. We sort of need to keep in mind that, you know, with COVID-19, with this particular coronavirus, there's probably been more information learned in the shortest period of time in the history of medicine. Now, I don't have actual data to prove that. That's just my sort of take on the whole thing. But I probably am not far off from being correct in that assumption. Now, the thing is, despite that, we're learning as we go. I mean, this has only been around for a little over a year and a half, and we're collecting tons of information, but it's changing rapidly. We can see that and feel that in the way we've lived our lives over the past year and a half. And so it is our current understanding that and belief that the vaccine that we currently have, that we've been giving, is effective against the Delta variant, but the Delta variant is more infectious. It's about 60% more infectious based on data from the UK. It also turns out that it's more transmissible than the strain that was previously present in the UK. What's been noted about it is that it has two important mutations in the spike protein. Now, that's what we developed the vaccine to, were the spike proteins. Currently, we believe that the vaccine will work. Having said that, it is possible that ultimately the virus will mutate in such a way that even the spike protein changes so much that it's not recognizable by our vaccine. And as a result, this is why there's been so much discussion about, will we need to get an annual vaccine, or is this going to require a third shot, or why not? And frankly, we know that this happens because look at the flu virus. We have to get revaccinated against the flu every single year.
So when you say it's more transmissible, does that mean it takes less of it in the form of droplets or whatever it is to establish an infection in somebody else?
So it may require a briefer exposure. It may be that one person can give it to more people, but it's easier to transmit. And there is a lot of similarity between the Delta variant and other. I mean, it's still at its heart, it's the same virus. It's just that there's been two mutations in the spike protein, and this has resulted in it being more transmissible, easier for people to get. And of course, that's where the problem lies, because it's easier to spread as a result. And that's why there's concern, because, you know, we do have a large percentage of people in the country vaccinated. And I'm not exactly sure what the number is, because there's so many different reports. But, you know, based on the number of people who've either gotten the infection or gotten the vaccination, there's, you know, roughly half the country's acquired some immunity to the coronavirus. Having said that, if this mutates enough, people could still be vulnerable irrespective of whether they've had it before or whether they've been vaccinated. But right now, the concern is the remaining 50% of people who haven't been vaccinated, are they going to be at risk, and is it going to spread widely through that group of people?
Okay, so it's more transmissible. What do we know about the symptoms? Is it still as deadly if allowed to run its course?
Oh yeah, I mean, the information from India has shown this. This is the predominant form of the virus in India, and you know, over there it's resulted in widespread death. Now, you know, first of all, their medical system has been overwhelmed. Our system was more capable of dealing with a pandemic than India's, and you know, we have access to a greater quantity of advanced medical care. India has advanced medical care. It's just not as widely available. So as a result, you know, the death rate has been much higher in India. But it definitely does result in death. I think it's a little difficult to actually calculate, when we're looking in a country like India, the likelihood of it causing death relative to some other strain. Even in the UK, I think it's difficult to sort that out. In many cases, you're actually doing the genetic typing of the particular virus after the fact. So there are some complicated issues that go into trying to sort these type of questions out.
Now, do they keep records so that we know if there are breakthrough cases? In other words, if people who have been fully vaccinated are still developing COVID. So do we know what the percentage of those are?
Right. So that's obviously one of the most sought after pieces of information. And I mean, we do expect there to be about a 5% failure rate, meaning that people who've gotten the vaccination will get a COVID infection to some degree or another. The original study demonstrated 95% efficacy of the vaccine in both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, and 85% in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, you know, we do expect, you know, 5 to 15% of people to either get the illness, but hopefully they'll get it to a point that they're not as sick as if they hadn't gotten the vaccine.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Time for this morning's military briefing. I always think it's a good thing to start off the week with a good, solid military briefing. And who better to do it than CBS News military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, who joins us live. So, based on everything that I've been hearing this morning about Iran's new president, he doesn't sound too warm and fuzzy. His name is Ibrahim Raisi, and he's been labeled a butcher. So, explain that to me.
Well, first of all, Dave, thanks for that very kind, warm introduction on a Monday morning. I really appreciate that very much. Yeah, warm and fuzzy would not exactly be terms that you would use if you were describing Ibrahim Raisi, who has made his way up to the leadership of Iran now as president through the judiciary. Some have described him as a brutal hangman. He will be one of the first world leaders elected who is also under sanctions, personal sanctions, from the United States as well as many European countries for about their abysmal record of human rights violation dating back to the 1980s when he was on judicial panels that many believe ordered the execution of 5,000 people that were held in prison for political demonstrations. And he presided over other brutal actions in days of political unrest in 2009 and 2019. So he is clearly the hand-picked guy by the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, and many of the more moderate candidates who thought to run for the presidency in Iran were disqualified by the so-called Guardian Council, which means this guy was basically rubber-stamped by the supreme leader for this job. Iranians know that, and we saw the lowest turnout that we can have ever seen in the Iranian since the Iranian Revolution in this particular election.
So tell me about that, this protest that the people put up. Does that have any effect? The mullahs have to consider that when half the people don't show up, don't they?
Well, that's exactly right. One would think that this would, many people wonder how Iran has survived, but it has shown amazing resiliency because there's a widespread belief that a large segment of the population are enormously disillusioned because of not only political repression, but widespread economic deprivation and also widespread corruption throughout the governments that Iran has had over the several years. And that's why a guy like Raisi has probably come to the top, because of his ability and willingness to do whatever it takes to keep this particular regime in power. But there's no doubt that the Iranian leadership is very concerned about the possibility of political instability. Not only did a lot of people not vote, but several million turned in so-called white ballots because the government can take some modest administrative action against you for not voting. Mm-hmm. So they just turned in blank ballots, you know, checked the block, but didn't actually vote for anybody. And that's probably some of the reason why many people still believe that despite his very, very conservative record, Mr. Raisi might be interested in seeking an agreement with the United States over nuclear weapons to get out from under the economic deprivation Iran has suffered and perhaps then satisfy some of the voters who obviously oppose him.
Right. So, in other words, they are motivated to strike a deal because they want those sanctions lifted. But, of course, the enemies of this deal say the moment those sanctions are lifted, Iran just goes full nuke. Now, do you think that's what they'll do?
Well, it depends on the agreement, of course, and what kind of restrictions they're under, and, of course, most importantly, the verification package that's put in place and our willingness to reimpose sanctions should we see evidence of them violating that particular verification. The second part of any agreement, I think most people would agree, is it has to be so-called longer and broader. What by that I mean the agreement's date has got to be extended. The current date for the original agreement was 2030. That's coming up in only a few years. So restrictions going beyond that on Iran nuclear activity. And second of all, most people at least want to see Iran agree to begin negotiations on other issues, such as their proliferation of long-range ballistic missiles, which now they've got some that can stretch for several thousand miles, as well as restricting their activities regionally in places like Syria, Iraq, Hamas, etc.
Okay, so then this would not be your grandfather's Iran nuclear agreement. This would be a whole new agreement.
At least a whole new agreement in the sense of the timing, the verification package, and some of the restrictions. Now, whether or not that will also include those other issues or whether that is just in the agreement, there is an agreement to continue further talks on those other topics, such as ballistic missiles and regional activities, remain to be seen. I think it's too much to expect a grand agreement that would cover all those topics. I think we're better, more likely to see agreement that'll be struck now between now and August when Raisi is inaugurated because it serves his benefit. If it works well economically, he'll take credit for the agreement. If it doesn't work economically, he can blame Rouhani and the last government.
Okay. Is Israel on board with this approach? Or because they're the ones who are in the bullseye here, aren't they?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the Grand Ayatollah has called Israel a cancerous tumor that must be renewed. That's not exactly endearing.
No.
But the new prime minister of Iran, Naftali Bennett, has been very opposed already to any type of agreement with Iran. And basically, in a statement just the other day, warned that the West has got to wake up to the threat posed by Iran. The new government that he now leads in Israel, having pushed out Benjamin Netanyahu after 12 years, in some ways is every bit as nationalistic, if not more so, than Mr. Netanyahu. There's 8 political parties that create this rather shaky coalition that all they can really agree on is that they don't like Netanyahu, and 3 of them, including Bennett, are probably far more nationalistic than Netanyahu ever was. So it's unlikely to see them come around to being in favor of any type of agreement with Iran. It's also very likely that Israel will continue the activities they have done, which has included the assassination of Iranian nuclear science and some attacks we believe they have conducted against Iranian nuclear facilities.
Okay. Let's move to Afghanistan. We are still removing troops. It looks like they're going to meet their September 11th deadline. But I also, as I recall, read something over the weekend that the Taliban have already started recapturing cities. Is that true?
Yeah, they've been recapturing at least districts. And since 1st of May, which had been the initial deadline under the agreement signed by President Trump for the United States withdrawal, the Taliban has seized about 32 districts across all the provinces of Afghanistan over the last few weeks, and we have not seen the Afghan security forces, though they have tried in a couple cases, actually recover any of that territory. It looks also very likely that they're now encircling several provincial capitals, and most experts, I think, seem to agree that they'll continue that effort, particularly in the rural area, and then following the departure of the United States and other allied forces, begin a more concerted effort directly against provincial capitals and perhaps eventually the capital of Kabul.
Yikes. And I thought that as part of this deal, we would sort of leave some spies behind, maybe in Pakistan. But now Pakistan has said, no, 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 we don't want your spies either. So does that mean we're going to go back to what it was before 9/11, where we have this huge, ungoverned and unmonitored area, which could be used again to mount another terrorist effort?
Well, that certainly is the worry, and many experts still believe that the Taliban maintains still close liaison with al-Qaeda. Now, al-Qaeda, of course, has been greatly diminished over the last decade or two. But even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, and the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, in testimony just last week, said the possibility of Iran becoming a place where terrorist groups could organize is at least in the moderate range over the next couple of years, because of the increasing stability and the success over the Taliban that we witnessed in the last few weeks. In terms of intelligence, this will be one of the critical factors. Do we still have intelligence on what's going on in Afghanistan once we've departed? Clearly, a lot of people who provide human intelligence for us, Afghans, I think will be unlikely to do that after we've left. And so the question becomes, can we maintain surveillance using satellites, using drone overflights, et cetera, that would give us the information if, in fact, we see an organized effort by the Taliban, or rather al-Qaeda, to conduct attacks outside the borders of Afghanistan.
CBS News military analyst, retired Army Major, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thanks very much.
Dave, have a good week.
All right.
Time your daily dose of kindness. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Chris Nickick became the first person with Down syndrome to ever compete an Ironman challenge. But what he did next was even more Herculean, taking a 14-year-old under his wing and planting a dream. CBS's Steve Hartman has the story.
For 14-year-old Caleb Pruitt of Jacksonville, Florida, who has Down syndrome, exercising anything other than his thumbs was never a passion. He could barely cross a pool, couldn't ride a bike without help, and saw the treadmill as little more than a novelty. Karen is his mom.
So triathlon wasn't on your list of things for Caleb to do?
It was not on our list, no.
At least, not until Caleb met 21-year-old Chris Nickich.
Did you like him when you met him?
Yes, I did.
What did you like about him?
Super cool.
Super cool, he said. Last year, Chris competed in that grueling 140-mile swimming, biking, and running race known as the Ironman. The first person with Down syndrome to ever cross the finish line.
If there was a poster with Chris on it, it would be in Caleb's room.
But what Chris did next was even more Herculean. He took this young fan under his wing, became a mentor, worked out with him, and planted a dream.
Just the fact that he was so warm and inspiring helped Caleb realize that these are things that I could do too.
Can and did.
Go, Caleb!
Last weekend, Caleb finished his first mini triathlon. He is believed to be the youngest person with Down syndrome to ever do so.
I've been selected.
He also received an invitation to compete on Florida's Special Olympics triathlon team. The same team Chris is on.
Do you want to be like Chris?
Yes.
You know what?
What?
I think you are like Chris.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes.
Is that like the best compliment you've ever received?
Oh, yes.
Heroes come in many different shapes, sizes, and abilities. But they all have the same superpower: to lift the hopes of others.
Oh, that's Steve Hartman reporting.
7:48, let's go to G. Scott from the G and Ursula Show for something having nothing whatever to do with the weather. We've been following this topic for a long time, whether NCAA athletes can get paid or even for colleges to, you know, bid up the price with the various sorts of goodies. And now the Supreme Court has said that, yes, this lawsuit brought by former athletes is has gotten their blessing. And while they didn't clear the way for actual salaries, they did strike down a law on how much schools can offer in, quote, education-related benefits. Now, you have a son who could be affected by this, right?
Do I? Yeah. Yes, I do. Let me just go ahead and explain it to everyone. So, when my son and other Division I athletes, when they go to college, they get a stipend. So every 2 weeks, my son gets a stipend, right? Now, good news is because he's from the state of Washington and he's traveled clear across country to the state of Ohio, he gets a little bit more money on his stipend. So I know you guys are probably wondering, how much does he make? Let's just say that every 2 weeks, let's say that they give him, let's just go with $500. Just use that number, okay? It's a cap on that. So $1,000 a month, that's the stipend they get. They use that to, you know, pay for things, whatever. Usually it's to help pay for their rent and where they live and all that. And yeah, they do. They get food at the training facility and all that. Now, what this is saying, basically, the Supreme Court is saying, okay, no more cap on that. In the past, before, there was always a cap. Like, each individual athlete can only be paid this much for their stipend, right? So only this much goes toward their tutoring. This much goes towards their computers, their books. And so it was always capped. Now, the Supreme Court says that's not fair. We're removing that. No, no, no. We're not saying we're paying the athletes. We're not saying we're paying them a salary. We are saying that it is unfair to put a cap on that. So now it's a good. So I gave you guys a $500 a week. Now going back, now the university might be able to say, okay, the Supreme Court removes the cold cap deal. Now, Baby G, instead of your $500 every 2 weeks, here's now $1,000 every 2 weeks. They can
all right,
do
so,
that.
So how does that help the – I see how it helps the athletes, obviously, but how does it help the university?
What do you mean? How? Wait.
Well, what's the university's motivation for raising – this is a recruiting tool.
First of all, the NCAA has no motivation and has not had motivation for years to give anything towards the athletes other than to make money off of the athletes. That's number one. Number two, there is really no benefit other than, yes, it will be start to be an advantage because now there will be schools across the country that have more money in their budget than others. So, yes, that will kind of be an advantage for some schools and maybe a disadvantage for others. But isn't that life? That's life, right? It's not fair for everybody. Everybody, there's somebody right now that is at work, and you're probably sitting or standing next to someone. You're probably doing the same job. Do you get paid the same amount of money? Probably not. Probably the person in front of you probably works less than you, and they still make more money than you. That's just the way of the world.
You're very fired up about this morning. I'm sensing,
Yeah, you know... Colleen, what you're hearing from me is this. There's so many layers to what the NCAA has done over the years that it's crazy. And the number one thing that they have done is this. They have turned it around and made it seem like, what, these ungrateful athletes? They get a college education. What are you talking about? Now, hold that thought. These, quote, ungrateful athletes have been getting a free education for over 50 years. Meanwhile, the compensation for the coaches and everybody affiliated with college football has gone crazy through the roof. So many people. I mean, I know individuals that make six figures from just analyzing high school athletes and saying, hey, this kid is a three-star. This kid is a four-star. They make six figures. The money in high school and college recruiting is through the roof.
So you think this ought to apply to high school athletes as well?
No.
We're finally talking about some serious wealth building here, G, for people who haven't had those opportunities before.
So when I say layers and levels, I'm not going into that because that would be a deeper conversation. But I will say this, since you just brought that up. Let's take soccer, right? Soccer is football, as they call it around the world, is a huge sport, right? Messi, the soccer player, he's been playing professionally since he was 12 years old. So in other countries, they don't have caps. They have clubs. They have young kids, 13, 14, 15 years old, being able to go and support their families. So back to what you're saying right now, Dave, no, I'm not going to go into the levels of that, because I do think that in the future, there's going to be issues that have come from that. Like anything that is new is going to have some bumps in the road. So I'll give you an example. When I talk to my son about what's going to happen with the name, image, likeness, because on July 1st, because he's in the state of Ohio, he's now going to be able to get paid on his name, image, and likeness. What does that mean? That means he can go to a restaurant and make a deal with them to promote their brand on his social media and be able to get something with this name and his likeness. Right. So, but now here's the thing. So on one hand, you can say, wow, that's great. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I had to tell my son, there comes a price with that. And so when you start getting around teammates, and then you guys are going to see what it's like to start getting jealous of one another. I've seen this happen in the pros.
Well, that's right. Like you say, welcome to the world.
Welcome to the world.
Welcome to the world. 9 o'clock, G and Ursula. Thank you, G.
See you guys.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. On the subject of getting help to people who've been overlooked for too long, families and children's hospitals are pushing Congress for more money to help kids who've been struggling with mental health issues, which have gotten much worse over the past decade. With the report, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Families across the country shared their stories with Congress and the nation last week as part of Speak Now for Kids Advocacy Week. Children's Hospital Association President Amy Knight says one particular area of concern, kids' mental health.
Children's mental health issues are not new. We were seeing a rise before the pandemic. We know that about 1 in 5 children and adolescents experience some form of mental health condition in any given year. I think if you look at the past year, we've seen that exponentially increase. We also know that about 50% of mental illness begins by age 14, and we really didn't understand that until earlier in this past decade. So that's a fairly new finding, but reemphasizes more the need to have a strong mental health care system for kids.
She says looking at the CDC stats from the pandemic period paints a grim picture.
Really from April to October of 2020, when, you know, the heart of the pandemic, for lack of a better word, if you will, in teens ages 12 to 17, there was a more than 30% increase showing up at any hospital in the U.S. And then even our younger children ages 5 to 11, 25% increase. Unfortunately, if you probably look at the pyramid below those statistics, which really just says about those showing up in an emergency room or in an inpatient unit for care, all of those that reached out in other places or are still trying to reach out to get care in their communities from a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, we know that number is really, really large.
That's right. We're talking extremely young kids struggling with some of these issues.
And kids is age 5 to 11. So it's really, you know, starting younger is really what we're seeing. I think we've all seen, you know, the anecdotal stories this past year of children 10 and under committing suicide, which is just kind of unfathomable. But it's where we are.
What's behind the ongoing growth in mental health needs for kids?
The pressures they have are different. The world is bigger to them. You know, ours was as big as our school and whatever we did. Theirs is social media and large. You kind of couple that with the pandemic and kids experience that very differently than we do as adults. We've had life experiences and we're more resilient in many ways. And so whether it be the staying home from school and the social isolation, even in very intact families, you know, you're seeing kids that feel anxiety, feel depressed. They don't have access maybe to extended family members or coaches or other sources of trusted adults in addition to their friends.
And there are some specific concerns when we talk about the impact of the pandemic, aside from isolation.
And you look at other families that have more challenges, trauma and dysfunction, and you see kids that are now thrust into that environment full time. And forced to do school from there. They may have had parents or family members that lost jobs. They may have lost a loved one due to COVID. And, you know, you read many reports that children are often fearful. They're the ones that brought it in the house. So we have just learned so much about this virus in the past year. I think we're just starting to learn the impact it will have on children long term.
It can be tough for parents to give their children what they need.
It's a challenge for all of us as parents too, because we're busy with our own lives and trying to manage some of these challenges as well.
One big shift we can all help with: destigmatizing the issue of mental health.
Just being there for our children and being connected to them and validating and listening to their feelings, whether it's, you know, an emotional outburst or whether it's, as you said, you know, someone coming to you after a period of time and saying things just aren't right, where they're linked to the outside world. And, you know, I think oftentimes children are more comfortable talking about issues of mental health than adults are. And so kind of destigmatizing that in our communities and in our families is going to be very important as we kind of soldier through these next years.
Wright says most adults share tons about their kids' other health needs, but when it comes to mental health, not so much.
When children are infants, parents share a lot about immunization schedules. And then when they develop asthma or allergies, they share names of doctors and what their experience was and things of that nature. And mental health just isn't something that we've talked about. So, you know, we often liken it to, you know, everyone knows someone that has had cancer, right? I mean, I think that's just reality. And I think now as we delve into this, we all know someone that has been touched by mental illness, and we all know a child or a teen that has been in touch by it as well. And I think, you know, the evidence coming out nationally and even in the state of Washington and Seattle, you know, says a lot about that. Just looking at the volumes of, you know, Seattle Children's Hospital there, you know, kind of in that same time period of last year, there was, you know, an increase of 67% of referrals to them for mental health, and they didn't have the capacity to take care of all of those. And that's what we're trying to fix by talking about it locally, by talking about it at the federal level and with Congress. You know, we need to change that and make sure that we're building a pediatric healthcare system that can care for the mental health needs of our kids.
One big need: counselors in every school, which as a state and a nation, we struggle with.
This is a partnership. This isn't going to be solved by the healthcare system or by the school system or by parents. You know, I think it's a matter of all of us coming together and recognizing that our legislative priorities need to focus on this. Certainly, you know, teachers are on the front lines of this, but they can't be teachers, therapists, and navigators. We need resources in our schools to link, you know, children and families to external. The teachers oftentimes are the best identifiers. They notice when a kid was off. And as you noted earlier, generations ago when we were kids, they may just have been bad behavior. Today, teachers are more savvy and better trained to understand that maybe this behavior is signifying something else going on with this child that we need to have checked out. But they can only be checked out if there's people to check them out.
Right now, there are not enough. Here's what's being asked for at the national level.
We actually, at the federal level, have a legislative bill strengthening kids' mental health now, which starts to address some of that, and certainly need to partner with states and communities to increase access to care and increase the care that's available, whether that be through school psychologists or school social workers, community-based therapists, resources in hospitals, so that children that need that level of care have access to it as well. We need to really shore up all of those in order to make sure that we can take care of kids in the years to come. The good news is that families are reaching out. The bad news is that we don't always have the capacity to provide the care that they need.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.